Today, the return of Sex and the City. I'm going to start, Hadley, a little bit differently from usual. I'm going to play you something. You know where I'm going with that.
Yes, I know where you're going with that. I enjoyed the little HBO logo sound at the beginning too. That was a good touch.
When you hear that, what does it kind of conjure up for you?
It just conjures up happy evenings, afternoons on my own in my little apartment, sort of blissed out watching Sex and the City. And now watching it on my box set, which I do quite a lot. I'm watching it when it comes up in reruns on TV. It's something that's pure pleasure to watch.
For Guardian columnist Hadley Freeman, the news that Sex and the City will be back on TV later this year is welcome. The show, which was loved by millions, had created a fantasy version of life in New York, something Guardian TV writer Hannah J. Davies only fully realised when she went there herself.
I went to New York on a school trip and I had all these expectations of it being super glamorous. But actually, when I got there, we were in a motel, which I think had bed bugs. There was a subway downstairs, as in the sandwich place subway. There were rats everywhere. I was like, oh, OK, so they were in the nice bit.
As the show is rebooted, how will a new generation of viewers respond to a programme that has been criticised for being too materialistic and too white? From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus: what the return of Sex and the City tells us about TV today. Just a warning before we start. As you'd expect, this episode contains sexual references that might not be appropriate for younger ears. Hadley, how would you describe Sex and the City for someone who's never watched it?
Sex and the City began in 1998, and it's a show about four single women living in New York in the late 90s and early 2000s. In no way is it supposed to reflect gritty reality. It is a fantasy with real emotions in it.
Once upon a time...
The main character is Carrie, who is a tabloid columnist who writes about relationships. She's played by Sarah Jessica Parker, of course, who is really kind of the captain of the show in a lot of ways. She's very instrumental in getting it put on screen and the look of it.
It's like the riddle of the Sphinx. Why are there so many great unmarried women and no great unmarried men? I explore these sorts of issues in my column, and I have terrific sources, my friends.
Then there's Miranda, who's played by Cynthia Nixon. She's a lawyer, quite tough, sort of the most down-to-earth of all the characters.
By the time you reach your mid-30s, you think, why should I settle?
Then there's Charlotte, who's the Upper East Side princess, played by Kristen Davis.
Most men are threatened by successful women.
She works in an art gallery and just wants to get married.
You have to keep your mouth shut and play by the rules.
And then finally, there is Samantha, played by Kim Cattrall, who is the very sexy downtown PR woman.
This is the first time in the history of Manhattan that women have had as much money and power as men, plus the equal luxury of treating men like sex objects.
Yeah. When I was watching it in the early 2000s, I was starting out working in a newspaper on the fashion desk at The Guardian. So, of course, I wanted to relate to Carrie. This was clearly a fantasy of adult life. But it was such a fun fantasy. And also what was fun about it was that these women were talking about things that, you know, we didn't really hear women talk about on screen.
I am so sick of these people with their children. I'm telling you, they're everywhere. Sitting next to me in first class, eating at the next table at John's show. Look at that. This place is for double cappuccinos, not double strollers.
To see these very glamorous, aspirational women talk about how they didn't want kids.
You're not going to defend children?
No, I don't like any children but my own.
There really weren't that many stories, either on screen or in books, that show women having those feelings.
And I'm going to say, having watched it back before speaking to you and being a woman in her early 30s in 2021, I still think it feels quite direct and upfront about these issues, you know, in a way that not many shows still are able to do today.
I agree. I mean, that anal sex episode is still kind of amazing. I mean, what do you think? Like, that was being shown on British TV screens in, I guess, like 2003.
Front, back, who cares? A hole is a hole.
Can I quote you?
Oh, don't be so judgmental. You could use a little back door.
I'm not a hole.
Honey, we know. Look, all I'm saying that this is a physical expression that the body was, well, it was designed to experience. And P.S., it's fabulous.
How did critics respond to the show at the time?
Shows that are made for women are always put under way more scrutiny than shows that are made for men. We saw this with Sex and the City and we saw this with Girls.
And you sort of waded into this discourse last week, didn't you? When you tweeted about this and you wrote, I find it fascinating that Sex and the City, a show about a bunch of white women making jokes and shagging, is considered embarrassingly retro and borderline offensive, but The Sopranos, a show about a bunch of white men killing each other, is considered an untouchable classic. You got quite a big response to that, didn't you?
I mean, I find that quite funny. I mean, the reason I thought of The Sopranos is, first of all, it was another HBO show that was on at around the same time. And secondly, because in 2013, there was a New Yorker article by Emily Nussbaum specifically writing about Sex and the City and The Sopranos, looking at how their reputations have endured. Why is Sex and the City seen as embarrassing and The Sopranos is elevated? So I was kind of referencing that. I really stand by my point, which is that Sex and the City is about serious emotions, that the show dresses up around it with this kind of fun fantasy about sexual pleasure and beautiful clothes and, you know, all the kind of lovely trappings of Sex and the City. Yeah. Similarly, The Sopranos is a show about real emotions.
Christopher, we're here to talk about your drug problem.
What?
We see a lot of, you know, questions about masculinity and questions about the relationships between the men.
But I want you to know that we're here today because we care about you.
What was this, your idea?
And around that, it is dressed up with a very typically masculine fantasy of gangsters and shooting and killing.
Come on in, rat.
And I think it is worth looking at why Sex and the City's morals are seen as so much worse than The Sopranos. Why is Sex and the City criticized for being too white? The Sopranos is entirely white. To me, they're two sides of the same coin. One is done in a very feminine way and one's done dressed around in a very masculine way.
And just like New Jersey is an integral part of The Sopranos, New York plays a huge role in Sex and the City. But how realistic is the vision of New York that it shows?
Well, it's obviously showing a very narrow slice of New York City. For a start, it's almost entirely just showing Manhattan. It's showing a very ritzy idea of Manhattan.
While Samantha had little belief in the idea of happily ever after, she had a very strong belief in the idea of a smart cocktail at the end of the workday. Samantha, a cosmopolitan, and Donald Trump. You just don't get more New York than that.
Listen, Ed, I've got to go.
Yeah, good.
But think about it.
Yeah.
I'll be at my office at Trump Tower.
Good.
In terms of realism, like, this is a show, like you say, that is very much about New York, filmed over 1998 to 2004. You know what's never mentioned in the show? 9/11. It was never supposed to be a realistic depiction. It's a fantasy as much as Breakfast at Tiffany's is.
And it's escapism, isn't it? And it's still iconic for people who go to New York today. That program, it sort of captured it at a particular time.
Very much so. I mean, when I was living in the West Village, there used to be a Sex and the City tour that would go past my house twice a day, which is how I knew what time it was.
My name is Melissa. I'm your tour guide. And we are going to the Pleasure Chest, which is where Charlotte starts a battery-operated relationship with the rabbits.
People looking around and seeing, you know, the Magnolia Bakery and seeing Carrie's house.
Are we ready for a cocktail?
It's a dream vision of New York, this kind of beautiful place with really fun clubs and beautiful brownstone houses.
Something it's criticised a lot for it is how it presented a very white vision of New York City. You know, the cast were all white. I mean, didn't it have a responsibility to be more diverse and actually reflect the city that it was set in?
New York is, of course, a very, very ethnically mixed city, but there are pockets of it that are quite segregated. And the women were living in some of those pockets, no question, in kind of the ritzy neighborhoods. Truth is, a lot of TV shows set in New York, or actually a lot of TV shows made in America, certainly in the 90s and before, are kind of monocultural. I mean, Seinfeld is entirely white.
Did you just double dip that chip?
Excuse me?
You double dipped the chip!
Friends is obviously entirely white.
Oh, the pizza guy's here.
What, you ordered pizza without me?
No, we ordered the Joey special.
Two pizzas?
And then on the other hand, you have things like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which is people of color.
Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down. And I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air.
American TV for a long time kind of really segregated black shows and white shows. The Jeffersons, Cosby Show, that's not defending it. Of course they should have a more diverse cast.
Right, and the lack of diversity in the casting is something that people have said will need to be addressed in the reboot this year. Another thing the show has been criticised for is how materialistic it is.
When I finish a new piece, I usually celebrate by opening a bottle of Chateau Latour. How do you celebrate?
By buying shoes and purses.
Well, in that case, have you ever heard of the Vogue accessories closet?
They are wearing these ridiculous clothes. In no way is it realistic that any of them would be wearing those clothes all the time.
Do you know what these are?
We're not even supposed to be in here.
Manolo Blahnik, Mary Janes. I thought these were an urban shoe myth.
I don't think anyone really believes that a lawyer like Miranda would go to lunch wearing Carolina Herrera, and that Carrie, a tabloid columnist, would be wearing vintage Chanel all day while hacking out columns at her desk.
Do you think some elements do come across as a bit crass, though? You know, Carrie's referencing to her ghetto gold, for example.
The ring was not good.
What do you mean?
It was a pear-shaped diamond. Oh. With a gold band.
Oh, ick!
Ugh, no wonder you threw up.
It's just not me.
You wear gold jewelry?
Yeah, like ghetto gold for fun, but this is my engagement ring.
Referring to something as ghetto gold, yes, that's really kind of crass and clanging now. At the time, that was a phrase that was wrongly used in fashion magazines, so it wasn't coming out of nowhere. And I'd say, you know, looking at the other shows that were around and have come since, Sex and the City has kind of held up better than most of them.
The series ended in 2004 with Carrie telling us that the most exciting, challenging, and significant relationship of all is the one you have with yourself.
And if you find someone to love the you love.
Hi.
What's shaking, baby?
How's Napa?
The house is on the market.
Well, that's just fabulous. For a show that celebrated single women, all four characters at the end are settled with partners. What did you make of that as a narrative?
Yeah, I mean, the show lost its nerve, without a question. The whole thing about how Carrie has to get back together with Big was ridiculous. Big had treated her appallingly. And it was sort of sad that the series did that. It really could have ended with, you know, one or two of them with somebody and the other two not. But at that point, the show had gotten so big, they were scared of letting people down. And they thought women need this happy, quote-unquote, happy ending.
But the story didn't end there. It was so popular, people wanted more, and they brought out two films. The first one begins with a wedding.
The ultimate single gal, Carrie Bradshaw, will be married in Manolo's to New York financier John James Preston come fall.
Our wedding's on page six.
Who would put that in there?
Proving to single gals everywhere
that there can be a happy ending over 40.
You've written about why you didn't like either of the films, Hadley. Why not?
They took everything that was good about the show, which was the spiky humor, the truth of the friendship between the women, the sort of originality of the writing, and made it what the show's worst detractors said the show was, which was these kind of awful women constantly talking about men, being incredibly materialistic in a way they never were on the show. It was sort of bizarre.
Vivian Westwood. A dress so special, it could bring a wedding tear from even the most unbelieving of women.
You know, with these kind of weird racist stereotypes as well, dotted around, particularly in the second film where they go to Abu Dhabi for no obvious reason.
I've always been fascinated by the Middle East, you know, desert moons, Scheherazade, magic carpets.
And what's weird is it was everybody from the show was involved in making the movies. It was Michael Patrick King, Sarah Jessica Parker. You sort of watch anything. Did you not understand your own show?
The robes are called abayas, and the veil that covers everything except the eyes is a niqab.
Certainly cuts back on the Botox bill.
It sort of broke my heart reading the male film critics reviewing the film.
It is consumerist pornography. It is an orgy of dripping, you know, just dripping wealth that made me want to be sick.
As you say, it was the same team working on this. It was the same characters. It was strands of the same storylines. What went wrong?
The way the show became such a huge success and the enormous expectation on these films, I think kind of crushed the people involved, to be honest. I think it was just too much pressure. And instead of aiming for a niche audience, sort of wised up, cynical female audience, it realized it had all these kind of young women fans who were there for the fashion, there for the romance. And none of those things are bad. I'm not disparaging any of those things. And I think those fans could have handled a bit more salt in the sweetness, really. But I think for the people behind it, they were like, this is the new Bridget Jones. We've got to give them the Cinderella ending.
After this, a new series for a new audience. What will the Sex and the City reboot called And Just Like That look like in 2021? Hannah J. Davies, you're the deputy TV editor for The Guardian. Sex and the City is back with a new name.
And Just Like That.
Why is this happening now?
We've seen in the past few years quite a lot of TV reboots and a kind of risk-averse attitude by a lot of broadcasters in bringing back things that have already been a hit. And I think now more than ever, TV production has obviously been massively disrupted by the pandemic. We're still seeing shows being pushed back and back. And so I think it's banking on things that are a guaranteed win.
And who do you think is actually going to be watching it?
I think there's just this great democratisation now of TV with streaming. So I guess the audience is kind of infinite, really. It could be maybe even people who weren't actually born when the series first aired or who were toddlers when it first came out.
And I wonder if those younger viewers will be coming at it with a slightly different mindset to the ones who watched it the first time round.
Yeah, I think that's interesting as well, because there may also be younger people who've come to the show in a more ironic way, not to say that they're mocking it, but in a way that acknowledges that its limitations. If you go on the hashtag Woke Charlotte, there are all these posts written in the fictitious voice of Charlotte, and one of them shows Carrie, and she's describing ghetto gold, what she calls ghetto gold jewellery. And Charlotte then says, that statement is deeply classist and displays a complete lack of awareness of your privilege as a white woman. So fans putting how they might want her to have reacted into that situation.
The cast members themselves have acknowledged as well that it has to be different. I mean, Sarah Jessica Parker has said before that, you know, you couldn't make the show today because of the lack of diversity on screen. And Cynthia Nixon has also actually said, we don't need another Sex and the City because we learned the lesson of the show. Marriage isn't the be-all and end-all in women's minds anymore. You know, she acknowledges that women's relationships, women's lives have changed. Could they find a clever way to provide people with that escapism, but also reflect the lives of the people who are watching it?
I've said, you know, making piecemeal changes to shows, I think, is kind of irrelevant and a bit offensive to other people. But equally, the world has really moved on. I was just watching back one of the early episodes, which was all about how men love models. And obviously it was a tongue-in-cheek episode, but I suppose we're now a level beyond that.
There's nothing like raising the subject of models among four single women to spice up an otherwise dull Tuesday night.
They have this distant, sexy look.
That's not sex, it's starvation.
That's starvation in the best restaurants.
Yeah.
And likewise with diversity.
Hello, sisters! Hello, siblings who reject the gender binary!
Cynthia Nixon has been a huge advocate for LGBT rights.
As LGBT people, we know how important coming out is. But I would argue that our coming out has never been more important than it is right now.
So I think you'd hope that her participation might mean that any questions about that might be taken really seriously within the writers' room. I think there's a space for it still to be fun, escapist, glamorous telly, but it would also be harmful for it to exist in that same bubble that it did, let's say, in 2010 with the Sex and City 2 film.
I mean, we live in such a different era of dating now, don't we? Social media, apps, they've really changed that.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because so much has moved on, and a lot of people watching will probably be thinking, should I have children because of climate change? And can I even find a partner? You know, will anyone reply to me on Bumble? So there's that as well.
Yeah, I want to see the Sex and the City Hinge version.
That would just be them getting ghosted.
A very, very short, sad series. And Hannah, Sex and the City isn't the only classic show being revived at the moment, is it?
We're also seeing this with Gossip Girl. That's not a secret I'll never tell. That ended about 10 years ago, so that was a generation after Sex and the City. XO,
Gossip Girl. That's a show that is also set in an expensive New York neighbourhood.
Welcome to New York's Upper East Side, playground to all my friends.
And as with Sex and the City, the cast is almost entirely white. It's faced a lot of the same criticisms. Is that something they're taking into account with the reboot?
We've seen some cast photos, and from that there are at least two black female leads in the series. So they're clearly dealing with it by diversifying their cast, but I'd rather not see things be too heavy-handed when it comes to these reboots, because I know that the TV industry as a whole, every time that I speak to creators of colour, it is not a perfect world. So even if you do kind of diversify your cast, essentially it would be really interesting to know what's happening behind the scenes with Gossip Girl and who's involved with that.
As you say, Gossip Girl was made a decade ago. Have TV shows become more diverse since then?
If you watch TV, you'd probably think that the industry was doing really well and pioneering diversity, but unfortunately it is still quite limited in terms of who's actually making the decisions, who's actually writing the stuff, who's producing. And the TV industry is still predominantly white. So in the UK, Ofcom figures from last year show that the TV industry is 73% white and very male. So that kind of says to me that you can have more people of colour on TV, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're increasing representation.
What you're saying really is that even though it's many years on from when Sex and the City first came out, perhaps the landscape of TV commissioning has actually not changed that much?
I don't think it has massively. And I think that sometimes the exceptions to the rule maybe look like it has. So people like Issa Rae or even somebody like Mae Martin over here.
Hi, Mum, can I ask you something?
But darling, can you please turn the light on? I feel like I'm talking to a sex offender.
Can I ask you something, Mum? Am I needy?
In general, yes. Why else would my body have expelled you 4 weeks premature? You are literally sapping my resources.
Okay.
Usher in this trend for more authored TV series where people would play themselves, especially in half-hour comedy format. And I think that that in the past 10 years has been where we've seen some of the most interesting TV within the kind of sadcom, right? But I think now we're moving a step beyond that with a show like I May Destroy You.
I just wanted to know, how did last night end? I've got this thing in my head of, like, this guy.
That's still not the average show on TV. Yes, it did amazingly well. Yes, it's huge. But if you kind of wanted to say that's like the pinnacle of representation on TV, it's sort of not.
I did to, you know, just gather the pieces, any of the pieces.
Yeah, and the creator of I May Destroy You, Michaela Cole, who is a young black woman, has talked a lot about her struggle to retain ownership over this show, which was partly autobiographical. Which says a lot about where the TV industry still is.
Our industry is quite exploitative in that it wants all of the IP from the artist. And if the artist is generating the idea, I just don't think that's fair.
Yes, and she was originally in talks with a streamer. So the show was eventually an HBO-BBC co-production, but she was originally in talks with a streamer about making it for them, but they said you can't have any of the rights. And that was where the conversation, I think, ended with that particular company. It is really difficult to keep ownership of a thing that you're creating. And especially if you're somebody like her, she very much describes herself as an artist and you really see it as an art form and it's not a job. You know, you want to retain some rights to your work.
We talked about how disappointing the Sex and the City films were, and I'm sure some people might be concerned that a reboot of the show will just be more of the same. It's now being called And Just Like That. And it interests me that they have so much faith in it, that they're bringing it back even though Kim Cattrall, who played Samantha, is no longer in it. What do you want to see from it?
What I want it to be is what it used to be on the TV show. I find this idea that the show needs to be updated to reflect reality just completely bewildering. There was a sort of funny column saying what Sex and the City should be like now, and it said there may be a place for a new version of Sex and the City 20 years on. Perhaps instead of prioritizing sex and shopping, the coven could go wild swimming, own dogs, fret about their teenagers, debate the merits of Botox over HRT, have gay relationships, Instagram their favorite trees, and struggle back to the workplace. Okay, well, first of all, I don't want to see a TV show about people Instagramming their favorite tree. And also, I just should add that a lot of those issues were covered in the TV show. We did see Miranda struggling back to the workplace after having her baby. We did see Samantha going through HRT. We did see Samantha having gay relationships. The show was always at its best reflecting emotional truths, realizing you'd broken up with a good boyfriend, realizing that you've gone broke because you've been spending all your money on stupid stuff.
I spent $40,000 on shoes and I have no place to live? I will literally be the old woman who lived in her shoes.
Have you got a favourite Sex and the City quote, Hadley?
My favourite moment on Sex and the City is when Miranda finds out she's unexpectedly pregnant and Carrie goes with her to the abortion clinic and Miranda turns to her and goes, oh my God, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing?
Right?
Miranda, I cannot answer that.
Well, what do you think?
What do you think?
What do you think?
You want to go one more round?
I mean, this is a conversation so many female friends have had together.
I can't have a baby. I could barely find the time to schedule this abortion.
And I think of that line so much. And when I had a miscarriage about 2.5 years ago or whenever it was, and the hospital said I could go collect the baby's ashes 2 weeks later. And so I had to go out and collect the baby's ashes. And it was a whole big thing and I had to cancel work. And I was like, oh my God, I don't have time for this. And I thought, how could I have thought of having this baby? I don't even have time to collect its ashes. I mean, it was just like those lines that really sang with emotional truth. So that's what I want. I want women's interior lives. I don't need Sex and the City to reflect my external life.
Hadley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Hadley Freeman and Hannah J. Davies. Read their respective columns, reviews and interviews at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.